To the second episode of the Data Diversity Podcast. I'm here just by myself today without Kim and Claire, but I'm here joined by Alfredo Cortel Nicolau from the McDonald Institute of Archaeology Research in Cambridge. Thank you, Alfredo, for joining me today.
Hello, Lufty. Hello. Thanks for inviting me.
No worries. So let's just have a quick start. Maybe you could introduce to the listeners who you are and what your research is.
So I work in the Department of Archaeology, and I'm a computational archaeologist. So I mean, people usually outside from archaeology don't even think this thing exists. Many people still think of archaeologists as just, we just go and dig, and that's the only thing we do, but not really. We're doing lots of these kind of things. And I'm a member of the Computational and Digital Archaeology Laboratory from this department. And essentially I focus my research in the transition to farming in Western Europe. And what I do essentially is I study the cultural transmission of the different types of arrowheads to assess how the different how they reflect cultural change, and I apply different kinds of computational methods, just simulation, mathematical modeling, and all of these kinds of things to assess these changes in the material culture.
Interesting. So you're focusing on, I'm just trying to see if I get it right. So you're focusing on arrowheads to see, to look at a history of farming in Western Europe, and you're using that to project certain periods which maybe unaccounted for?
Yeah, because usually, so the types of arrowheads that I study are not what you probably have in mind, because you probably have in mind this kind of medieval, the arrowheads that we all know, but the types of arrowheads that I study is what it's called geometric microliths. And these are arrowheads that are thought to be as different composite tools in a haft. So they may have, I mean, one of the types is like a trapeze, another type is like a triangle. They don't have the typical shape of the arrowheads. And the thing is that these are really sensible to changes through time. So because they change through time because the different people do them in different ways, you can assess through all these changes, how is the transmission of culture between different groups by seeing now we change from this shape to this other shape, and this change has been fast, has been slow. And you can kind of assess how the different groups were evolving into different cultures, into different things, just by seeing how they were, the changes in these arrowheads.
It's so interesting, the idea of material culture and the story that it tells about human history and human evolution.
One of the main things that we do, I mean, in my case, I do it with arrowheads, but some of the, because I don't have all that much pottery, but for example, for people who do pottery, they do it with pottery design. Then when they have, I mean, it's really classical, you know, typical in archaeology, when they have other types of instruments. So these changes in these instruments can tell you something about how the different cultures evolve and interact with each other. So it's, yeah, it's really interesting, all this.
So as I told you before, I like to ask these three questions, and you kind of answered a little bit about it, but I'm very interested in obviously the kind of research data you work with, but I like to ask it in a slightly conceptual way by framing it, what is data to you? So you can answer it, you can choose to answer it in that conceptual manner, or just more sort of straightforwardly, what is research, what research data do you work with beyond, beyond what you've already told me?
Yeah, so there's, in archaeology in general, there is two ways to see the data. Because one thing is, one would think that, in my case, for example, one would think that the data is the arrowhead, and that's the primary data, of course, that's what you get. But then when I do my studies, I extract lots of morphometric measures, I start lots of different characteristics, it's a type of retouch, that's how they produce them. So, and then I produce the second level of data, which is, you know, my CSV files with all of these measures and with all the different information about the arrowheads. So what is the data? Is it the arrowhead, or is it the file with the information of the arrowhead? And this brings issues in terms of who owns the data and how you're going to treat the data, because it's not the same. So in my case, I always do everything reproducible, and I always share my data and everything. But when I share my data, I'm sharing the data that I collated from the arrowheads. I'm not sharing the arrowheads because they are not mine to share. So this is kind of a second layer of thought when you're working with archaeology. When you're studying, for example, pottery residues, then you're sharing the information on those residues, but you're not sharing the pot that you used to get those residues. So there are two levels of data, which is the actual data itself, but then which can be reanalyzed in different ways by different people, or the data that you extracted only for your specific analysis, which can be these infometrics or whatever information you want to get. So I see data in this kind of twofold way, and because this implies that there are different ways to liaise with it in terms of there are, when you're talking, when you're thinking about the actual arrowhead or the actual pot or the actual vase or the actual pottery, whatever, then there you need to liaise with all the different regional and national laws regarding heritage and how they want you to treat the data, because it's going to be different for every country and even for every region. Then, of course, when you're using, let's say, all these morphometric information, all these CSV files, the way to liaise with the data, the way of who is the owner, it becomes a really different thing. So you kind of have to think of this in this kind of twofold way of the data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, because that's one of the things about archaeologists or archaeology as a field that really strikes me as interesting. There's this awareness that the data that you collect, as you put it, do not rightfully belong to you. And they belong to indigenous groups or people like local to the sites. Yeah. And one is reminder of the acronym CARE, you know, collect benefit, authority control, responsibility, ethics. So very interested if you could speak more about this. Have you been in situations where, or are you familiar with some situations where, you know, you find something and then an archaeologist wants to claim its rights to it, but you know, the indigenous groups disagree and, you know, any sort of tension like that? Because I find it really interesting. I don't think there's many, I guess, archaeology and anthropology where there's a collaboration research. You find the situations where the acronym CARE comes in. So, yeah, can you speak more about that? Like, have you seen anything? Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I have not had problems with indigenous groups because my area of work is basically Western Europe, so I don't get to have those kinds of problems. The problem that you do have is, for example, in theory in archaeology, the one who is collecting the field data, if we are talking about a new excavation, is the field archaeologist, and the field archaeologist may or may not be the same who is going to then do the analysis, and often there are some issues in how do you acknowledge that the field archaeologist is the one who got that data, because sometimes say that you might have excavated a site in the 70s and some other researcher comes later and they may be doing publications after that site, but you are not always giving the proper attribution to the field archaeologist because you cited the first excavation in the first publication and you're done. And sometimes that makes field archaeologists to be reluctant to want to share the data, because they don't feel that their work is acknowledged enough, and they feel like they are doing something that is not, because even more today that we all do all these macro analyses all over Europe with all of these different DNA and a different radiocarbon dates with all of these huge studies, the people who is doing the field work is not feeling enough acknowledgement, and that is one issue which we try to sort. And I guess this will be common to many other disciplines, as in when you have this huge, say, radiocarbon database, 5,000 dates. Of course, if I go and use that database, I will cite whoever did that database, but I will not be citing everyone who actually contributed indirectly to that database. So how do I include all of these citations? Maybe, and we discuss about these, like meta citations, I don't know, but there has to be some way in which everyone feels that they are getting something out of sharing the data, because otherwise there is a reaction which is more or less understandable, which is, well, just I won't share it. There's nothing in for me to share it. So why should I share my data? And this is something that is going on in terms of how research is evolving today. And in terms of dealing with indigenous communities and everything, the closest thing I can say to that is when we have had to deal with private owners, local politicians, different heritage caretakers. Not everyone feels the same way. Not everyone feels the same way about everything. And you do need a lot of diplomatic skills to kind of navigate through this. Because in order to excavate a site, you need all kinds of permits. You need the permit of the owner of the site. You need the permit of the municipality, you need the permit of the regional authorities, you need the permit of the museum where you're going to store the material. So you need all of this to work, and you need the money, of course, and you need all of these to work, and you're going to have to liaise with all of them. And I guess if you are introducing problems with not problems, but different levels of discussion with indigenous communities, then of course, then it adds another layer of complexity, which you have to deal with them. And in some cases, like in the site we're excavating now, the owner is the sweetest person in the world. And we were so lucky to have this owner, because I called him yesterday or 2 days ago, because we were going to go to the site. And I was just joking with him, and saying, I'll try not to break anything in your cave. And he was like, this is not my cave. This is heritage for everyone. This is not mine. This is for everyone to know and to share. And it's like, okay, that is so nice to find people like that. And I guess that may happen also with some kinds of indigenous communities. It may be different on every case. The levels of politics and negotiation probably are different in every case. So
yeah. That's interesting. So there's this level of interpersonal skill that's actually needed in archaeology. It's not even digging the ground. You almost need to, in a way, dig through your own personalities to sort of reflect and be, you know,
yeah,
personable and be a people person, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Because I might be wrong, but the way I see other disciplines, say medicine, for example, so they want to do a study and they think we need 2,000 patients or whatever, how many we need. We have the budget, and then we call the people and we do it. And they have all other ethical issues they have to deal with. But it's kind of thought from the beginning, there is less. So they know they will need that many people, and they know they will do that to that many people because that's what the study requires. In our case, you know what you want, but you don't know what you will be able to get, because that is going to depend on all of these politics. And even on that, you may want to excavate this site because you think the site is going to be the best in the world. And then you go there and you find nothing. And that can happen. And maybe you're excavating just 1 meter away from the place where everything is. But that can happen. Or the other way around. You may find something unexpected, then it becomes something huge when you thought it was going to be just a little thing. So all these kind of unexpected things add risk, a layer of risk that has to be accounted for when you're working with archaeology. You cannot have, I will do my test and that many people, I will get these results. That's just not how it works. It depends on so many things. And you need to include these in all your different risk assessments and how you're thinking of your research.
So when you say include this in your risk assessment, you sort of write it in your proposal or your DMP, I suppose. And is it accepted in your field and by your funders, that typically in archaeological excavation or field work, that things like this do happen?
So there is one thing, one level. So there is one thing that no one can guarantee 100% that you will find what you're looking for. And that's acknowledged. This said, because this is acknowledged, you need to provide some levels of feasibility. So even though we know that it may be the case that you don't find something, you need to have a plan B. You need to know that there's a high chance that you will find something in whatever site you're excavating. And you need to think of ways, what happens, and this needs to be included in different projects. What happens if you go to your site and you're thinking of finding this level with this chronology and you don't find it? What do you do then? Because you still have the money, you still have to do something with that money, and what you were looking for, you didn't find it. So what are you going to do? And you need to kind of think of what will you do in case this doesn't happen, in case this happens. And this feasibility is something that always has some special emphasis in archaeology, because whatever you propose in every project, in every DMP, needs to be feasible, it needs to be realistic, and needs to acknowledge all the different things that can happen. And also, and this is not just matter from archaeology, but from every scientific discipline, I guess it will be the same for all of them, I guess, biology, geology, everywhere when you are working around the world, you also have to acknowledge different potential situations in different countries in terms of legal issues, things that can happen. All of this needs to be included in how you're framing your project.
Interesting. I want to pick up on something you said, because you sort of painted the picture of the different levels of human relationships involved in an actual, say, single field work that come maybe before and after the time of the field. So what happens when these human relationships go wrong? if they change, if say you're not able to establish a relationship at one chain of the whole project, or if they change in while the project is in process, what happens then?
It may happen, and in general with local authorities, that's usually not an issue because everything is like legal ways of doing things. So it's really weird that you have problems, say, with the regional authority. That usually doesn't happen. But what does happen is, I don't know if it's the same in every country, but I know it is in most Mediterranean countries. When you need the permit of the owner of the site, if the owner changes his or her mind, or if the owner, for whatever reason, sells the property or everything, if this happens, then you have two options. You either enter into a new negotiation with the new owner, or you may have to just leave it there. And it's weird that this happens on an ongoing excavation, but it may happen. I mean, it's been the case for me and for several other colleagues where we wanted to dig one site and we couldn't, because just the owner was just not interested. And in this case, he just didn't want archaeologists being in his field, because it was his field and he just didn't want to do anything with it. And if that is the case, there's nothing you can do, really. I mean, you just need to try to negotiate with them. But if they don't want to, in the end, it's their property. So you can call the government, expropriate, and all these kinds of things. But you're not gonna do that. I mean, no. So there's little things you can do if that happens. But this usually doesn't happen on ongoing excavations, because if the owner in the beginning was happy with you being there, in general, then they see that, I mean, we don't do anything. We just go there, dig a hole, and go back home. So why would they care? So it doesn't happen. But if it does happen, then yeah, sometimes you may have to, you need to renegotiate, or you may have to shut it down in case you are not able to reach an agreement.
Interesting. It makes me wonder, when you approach a field order or people who have this sort of control over the sites that you want to go to, how do they view the archaeologists and the work that you do? Is it as an annoyance, or is it as a fellow archivist?
Yeah. There is really, it really depends on the owner. As in, like the one that we're working with now, in his case, he's super happy because he didn't know that he had archaeology in his cave. So now when we told him, he's super happy because he's able to bring something to the community, and he wants us to do things, and he wants the cave to be known, and he wants his local community to be aware that this is going on in here, and that there is something valuable in terms of heritage. And this is one extreme good example. But we have also had other examples. Like I remember in this case, this was the owner of the cave was a lawyer in this case. So the first thing he thought was, are there going to be legal problems for me? Because that was his work, as in, if people comes from the outside, if something happens in the cave, who's the legal responsibility? In another case, there was another person that just didn't care. Just said, you want to come? Fine. The field is there. Just do whatever you want. Didn't care. And in another case, there was this other one that so there is really different sensibility to this. Some people is really happy about the heritage, and some people just see this as a nuisance that they have to deal with. And it's like, why should I care about these people coming to my field or my cave and do their thing? So it really depends on an individual case. So
interesting. How about yourself as a researcher and archaeologist? Do you see yourself as a custodian of sorts, or someone who's trying to contribute to the sort of local heritage of the place, or is it just kind of like almost scientific where you just did the dig almost?
I'm sorry, you didn't get that.
So how do you view yourself when you approach a local landowner or someone like this? Do you see yourself as a custodian of sorts, or someone who has sort of care of the materials that are there, or someone who's trying to contribute to the local heritage?
Yeah, in my case, when I approach the different owners, I think the most important thing is like it happened in this case, to let them know that they have something first that is valuable to the local communities, and they can be a part of that. They can be a part of being valuable to the local community. Also, you have to make really clear that it's not going to be a nuisance for them. they don't have to do anything. It's not going to be a problem for them. We take care of everything. We do everything. They don't have to do anything. And I think the most important part is letting them know how this can be valuable for everyone. And another thing, I usually like them to be involved, as in they can come and see the cave and see what we are doing. And be, in the end, is their land. And if they see that that we are producing something that is valuable to the community, then I think it's really good for them. Because then, in this case, this is the type of data that we produce when we excavate, is that primary type of data. So we get the actual different pottery shirts, the different arrowheads, the different earrings, the different everything we get. And when you get them to feel, think like, for example, in this excavation, we got an arrowhead. It's probably some 4,000 or 5,000 years old. And when you get them, like, you touch this arrowhead, and no one in 5,000 years has ever seen this. You are the first person to see this in 5,000 years. And that's kind of a feeling that you get when you get them. And if you can get the owners to think of it in this way, as in you're doing something valuable for your community, then they will be more happy, of course, to participate in this whole thing and to just let us do whatever we want to do, which is science.
Mm. So interesting. Yeah. How about the funders? Like, so you speak of these two levels of data, the primary data and the analysis, which is also a substantial amount of data. What do the funders see as data? What do they want from you as part of sharing? Is it the level two? Or do they want also have a sort of say in the level one?
I think, so there are two ways. I think I don't think they want anything in special, anything specific, but I think it's kind of not exactly whether they want this level one of data or this level two of data, but whether is it going to be good data. As in, a funder can be interested in, say, if you have a site and you find a site with exceptional preservation conditions and with human bodies and with lots of beautiful arrowheads, that's something interesting that people would be interested in. And this, you can use it not only for research, but this can go to a museum. This can have all of very different ways of contributing to society. You can do different open days, whatever, and you can contribute locally with that data. But now, what we are doing today is lots of what is called a macroarchaeological approach. And to do that is essentially studying, say, large areas, all the Western Mediterranean, all Scandinavia, all, you know, it's putting a lot of these things together. But to do this, you need all that secondary data and you need huge databases. And lots of the funders are interested in this. When you can say and you be positive that you will have some of the largest database of radiocarbon dates, morphometric measures for arrowheads, DNA, whatever. So when you have these things, this is interesting also for funders, because you're producing something that can be then reassessed and reanalyzed by everyone. And I think that, I guess that's probably not just archaeology, but all the open data movement now is really important in archaeology, and is something that, for example, the European Commission via the ERC projects and all of this is something they are requiring us to do, hence all the DMPs and everything. And I think being able to produce a large amount of data in whatever type of data is going to be interesting for all of these founders. And it's an output in and of itself. There's that you can have just on a standalone basis. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's so cute. You know, when you talk about this open data movement, and then you talked about how some archaeologists, they don't want to share because they feel like they're not getting the right sort of, attribution or the right attention. Does something like open data, does it help in that actually? In actual fact, wouldn't sharing your data or whatever you sort of find as you find it, does that help with an archaeologist in getting the right reputation? Or do you see where I'm going with this?
Yeah, I do. I see. Yeah. I don't know, because so archaeology is in a way dichotomical, for saying. So you have different groups of you have lots of currents as in every scientific discipline, but let's just put it this way for now. And you have like some archaeologists that are all for the sharing data and all for these kind of things, but some others are more like the classical view of archaeology, and they focus more on their own site and whatever they are doing. So they don't really need all that data sharing devices. So they just care about their own site, and they have their own things. They don't feel into this whole say more global approach. So I think there is a feeling sometimes that some people don't want to share the data because they are not feeling the attribution. And I don't know if this movement is helping them to share or is actually creating more, in the extreme cases, more, say, unsafety for them. As in, you know, feeling that in the end, everything is free. There's also one thing in archaeology, we assess a lot the quality of the data at a micro level. As in, this site has this information, but this was not properly excavated for whatever reason, because there were problems in the site or whatever. And this needs to be acknowledged because it can bias a final result. And this is something we cannot do when we are looking into large databases, because we just don't have the time nor the means to do that. I mean, if you are getting 5,000 dates, you cannot assess them individually. You just need to rely on whatever someone said at some point. And this is one of the issues for some people that they feel that they should get more acknowledgement for being the ones that actually had this first assessment of the data, and they are providing, like, they are the ones who are actually making sure that the data has good quality. Because when you're collating all of that, you cannot do that. So the ones that are in the field are the responsible for the data being good. So yeah, I don't know. For the different conversations that I've had, I don't think this is so far helping. I don't think the open data movement is making them more open to share data. And I've been able to convince someone, but sometimes it's just, you just can't. And sometimes they can't because they're in the middle of a study, and we all understand that. It's like they still have their own data, they're still finishing things, so that's fine. But sometimes it's difficult, and I don't know if we will ever be able to convince everyone about sharing the data. And I know this case, this researcher, he's an American researcher, and he used to finish all his presentations in conferences, I think he still does, saying, people, please share your data. And he used to do this every single presentation, and he was just partially successful. It was just, so yeah, I don't know. We'll see. I guess it also depends on who the person is, and it depends a lot on, there are different national cultures on this, and different countries see this differently. And I'm talking about Europe. I don't know in other places, but I do know that it's not the same Spain, than France, than the UK, than Italy. Their approach to data is different, and it's something you also need to acknowledge when you're going to be dealing with these kinds of things. So.
That's super interesting. I guess you could see maybe an equivalence in, say, certain lab cultures where certain technicians don't get get acknowledgement, and only the major scientists.
Yeah.
And I think some of that is being addressed in the whole sort of research culture transformation that's happening in at least in Cambridge, that's happening, and maybe in the UK, and I'm sure in Europe as well.
Mm-hmm. So how is this being addressed, for example, because I think
they're gonna give sort of citations to the lab technicians as well in some cases, and they're starting to see that their name also gets cited, and it's part of the DOI. I think they could be acknowledged in the writing itself.
Mm-hmm.
So it could just be maybe for now still on the surface, but at least there's a shift towards acknowledging that these people as well play a role. And maybe in the humanities there's more of an awareness on this, the idea that in anthropology, for instance, the idea that data is collaborated as opposed to one researcher finding getting all the genius points or whatever.
Yeah.
So, and what you say in actually is very interesting. And I wonder whether, whether diggers or people who help at the sites, are they often, perhaps they're acknowledged on a personal level between the archaeologists and their assistants, but they're not acknowledged in the work, are they?
It depends. So there are different levels of collaboration and different levels of specialty, and different types of directors. So I think if you have some specialist, say you have a geologist that comes and does something at the site, he will be acknowledged and he will probably sign whatever publication comes out from it. And that's fine because that's specialist intervention. So you're going to do something with this geologist or you're going to do something with this pottery expert. So they will be acknowledged and they will have their own data and things. Now, it gets more tricky with, just say, plain field work workers, because these have very different levels of expertise. Some of them are professional, some of them are students that are learning. So you have very different levels of expertise in this. And then different directors see differently. In my case, as a director, I think that when you are doing a publication, like a general publication of the site, I think everyone should sign that publication. Everyone that worked at the site, from the undergrad who was digging at the site to the highest level specialist. And I think because they all contributed to that, they all did something, so they should all sign at least that publication. Of course, if you are then doing specific things, then just the people working on those things have to sign the publication. But I think when we start publishing about this site, my intention is to include every student that has been coming from the first campaign until these campaigns, because I think that's one of the ways to acknowledge the work they have been doing. And I think several students use this for learning, but I think, and it's fine, and they learn through this and it's fine, but I think because most of the ones who excavate are thinking of pursuing some kind of academic career, I think it's good for them to start signing things, seeing how it works. And it certainly doesn't harm us. I mean, who cares about being 9 or 10? I mean, in the paper. So it doesn't harm us, it helps them. So I think everyone should be included in these general publications, but it's not always the way it works. The way it works, sometimes they just include some collaborators, not all of them. It really depends on the director. And I think this is probably something that goes on in other fields as well. It's like, how much do you extend all the citation for everyone who participated in some way with in a research project? So that's the way I see it, but it changes depending on who. Then also a different thing again is whether you are hiring workers, and say you're hiring someone who is driving you to the cave, should that person be acknowledged? So there are different levels on everything. But I think we don't lose anything for acknowledging people. So I think we should.
I guess it's no surprise that you're also a data champion and an advocate for open research. I can imagine that it depends on, how experienced you are, how much pressure you feel to put your name out, or how much funding you received. But one thing that strikes me about archaeologists as well is somewhere where, the ethics of it all, the idea of wanting to share, wanting to not wanting to harm, wanting to share, it all comes to the fore a little bit. I think, I think the CARE acronym, maybe it's very relevant, I feel, to archaeology. And I think one thing that's also relevant is this idea of this idea that you have digital data and physical data, and they're both almost equally important, and they both require different policies, different rules. So I thought, before we end, I kind of want to ask you a little bit about this, and it seems like you have both data in the arrowheads. But then where do you store the physical data? Or is it even your right to store, or do you let the sort of landowners store it?
Yeah, so that depends on the national and regional laws. Different countries have different laws about this. In the case, the caves where I work right now are in Spain. So I'm going to talk about the Spanish law, which is the one that I follow. And I guess it's going to be different depending on every country. So in our case, the different assemblages that you find, you have a period of up to 10 years where you can store them yourself in the university, in whatever. And that period is for you to do whatever research you want to do with them. And after that period, then that goes to whatever museum they are supposed to be going. And the museum of choice is going to depend on, the law says that it has to be the museum that is the closest to the cave where you're excavating. So say if in the cave or the site where you're, so say if in the site where you are, the a town that is 10 kilometers away, they have a museum, then the Siemleches should go to that museum, which can then be exposed, and they can do, and they are the ones responsible for managing them, for storing them long-term and whatever. But there is one additional thing to this. If you are excavating a site that has already been excavated, because that happens a lot in archaeology. Some site was excavated in the 50s and they just dig 20% of it, and then you go again now and see another 20%, and this happens a lot. So if you're excavating something that was already excavated some time ago, then there is one principle of keeping the assemblages together. So say, for example, it happens a lot that there's this cave, I won't say the name because people won't know it anyway, but say there is this cave excavated in the 50s and they store all the assemblages in the Museum of Prehistory of Valencia, which is the one that was built at that moment in the 40s and 50s. And it was the only one in the whole region. Now they excavated it again a few years ago. And now there are museums that are closer to the cave because there are more museums now and they should go to these other local museums. But because the bulk of the collection of the assemblage is in Valencia and they don't want to have it separated in two museums, they want to have it all together, they still have to go to Valencia. And this principle of not having the assemblage separated is the most important one, because what they want to do with this is they want to avoid hassle of this level is in this museum, but this other level is in that other museum, and then this is in that box, whatever box. So then you end up, because you can have lots of material. So the first principle is principle of having the assemblages together in one same place. And then after that, you store it in the local museum. And after, like I said, some period that you are allowed to have them yourself for your studies. And then all this is kind of cumbersome in terms of bureaucracy, but then Spain is cumbersome in terms of bureaucracy. But it's not difficult. It's just, that's just how you do things. When you have to store it, then you need to fill your forms, your museum fills the forms, and then you just bring the data and there. And from that moment when they have it, they are the ones who are responsible for safekeeping and for proper storage of the data. In the case of lithic tools, it's not a huge problem because lithic tools, they preserve. But there are other materials that are more sensible. And whoever is going to be taking care of those materials has to be responsible for the preservation of those materials. And but in general, the museums are well prepared for that. And they have specialist people who is prepared to take care of all these things. So yeah, in the end, it goes to the museums.
But in the 10 years, where do you store it?
Well, in this case, for example, in this cave, because this is a collaboration between Cambridge and the University of Valencia. So in this case, they are storing it in the University of Valencia, which is also prepared to store these things. If I wanted to store it in Cambridge, that could be a problem. It can be done, but that would require more bureaucracy, more papers. I mean, it's not just as in, sure, I'll just take my stones with me. No, there's going to be some legal issues to go through if you want to store it in some other place. So the best thing, if you want to do thing, is to have some local support, some university that is working in the area, and you can work with them, and they can store the data while you study it and while you do things, because taking it out of the country is going to be, it's not impossible, but it's going to be a bureaucratic hassle. So at this moment, in this case, they're storing it in Valencia, and that's generally what they do. They store it either in local universities, or in some cases, when there's a really like a stable excavation, they may have special facilities for them. If they've been there for years, they may have special facilities. Like for example, say the people from Atapuerca have their own special facilities for storing things. And that's for really established and long-term excavations. They may have their own places where they can store it. And then also one good thing is that you do foster collaboration with the local museums. You do foster collaboration with the different universities, and people is nice in general. So they are willing to give a hand, and storing it usually is not a problem. You have different options to store it.
What are some of the challenges with the physical data? Like I imagine once it's dug out and it's exposed to the elements, it needs to be in a somewhere controlled environment. And what happens if you damage it in that 10 years?
Well, that is the responsibility of whoever is keeping it. Say, for example, like I said, lithics are not a problem. Lithics usually they are not damaged. But there are other more sensible things like wood, for example, like waterlogged wood, that is difficult to preserve. That can have problems. Or Roman mosaics, that's also really tricky thing. And all of that, as long as you are the one preserving it, because all of that is legally, I mean, you have your documents, you are the responsible for keeping it. So if it's broken, well, there will surely be some bureaucratic nightmare and some responsibilities. So you are the one who is, whoever is keeping it is the one responsible for keeping it safe. And if you don't, yeah, you will have problems. With heritage, legal bureaucracy, yeah, you're supposed to store it in the right way, and then, yeah.
Cool. I just want to ask one last question before I let you go, because you're a computationalist. So I wonder, and I'm sure you're working with sort of models to help you do your computational analysis and projections. So I wonder, how much does AI come into your research these days, and what do you think this is like the future of archaeology, and that there's a lot of room here for interesting projections or retro engineering in a way?
I think it is here, and I think it's something we have to incorporate in our research. I mean, it is going to be incorporated anyway, so it's better that we know how to do it properly, because I don't think there's stopping to this. And AI, you know how there are different levels of AI and what is actually AI. So if you go to, say, machine learning things, well, we've been using machine learning for essentially since the moment it came out. So we are integrating this machine learning into archaeology. If you go to different things, such as neural networks and everything, depends on who is doing what. Some people is using it, and with some nice results. And there is some people in Cambridge that is using those in terms of site recognition in India, and they are using different algorithms to try to automatically detect sites and all these kinds of things. So we are integrating all these different things. And also, of course, in terms of different devices helping us to develop models, to code everything. So all of these, I think, needs to be integrated. And I think it's a challenge for archaeology, in which for a very long time there are some theoretical debates which I'm not going to be explaining now, because I don't want to explain to you all the theory from the 80s, so I'm not going to go into that. But for some reason we've always considered two branches, where we have the quantitative and computational people in one side and the qualitative and, say, phenomenological people from another side. And I think now it's not a matter of choice anymore. I think now it's not a matter of branches or theoretical perspectives. I think intense computation is just something that it's in the everyday world, and we need it, and it's going to be there. So it's not your choice to try to stay with your own qualitative analysis. You need to incorporate all of these things, because otherwise it's just going to be impossible to analyze all the different data that you have. Because as in everything else, data keeps coming up. I don't know in your case, but I think we all struggle just to keep up to date with the different papers that come out. And we all need to read, and it's like there are more papers that I can read. And this is the same with data. So you either look for computational aid, or you just won't be able to. So I think, I mean, we are using it, and I think it's growing, the use of these kinds of techniques. And we do have one problem, which is that several archaeologists by training are not computational people, are not mathematics people. And that is a shortcoming that we need to face, and that we need to correct in a way, so that we don't need to be mathematicians, we don't need to be data scientists, we are archaeologists, that's fine, but we need to be able to include all of these different tools in our research, in the same way that we include DNA, in the same way that we include isotopes, in the same way that we have included technological analysis, in the same way that we include all of these different tools, we need to be able to include as a standard practice the different computational aspects and mathematical modeling aspects into archaeology.
So interesting, because at the start of this conversation, when I think of the archaeologists, you just think of basically, what's the classic meme of archaeology is the Indiana Jones, basically, yeah. The guy, in the desert digging stuff. But actually, it sounds like, you have to have that. And then you have to be a bit of an interpersonal person as well, because you need to make all these relationships and these negotiations with people and boards and governments. And then now you also need to be a bit of a software engineer almost, or someone who's also in conversation with the machines to be a complete archaeologist these days.
You need to do a lot of everything today. So in the end, it's changed a lot from the view of the Indiana Jones view and the view of the old archaeology. Just going there in the desert, and it's a completely different beast now. And but I think it's nice. I mean, I think it's got. I mean, this is making the scientific branch more rigorous. It's making it be more more open, more consistent. And I think from some years up to now, we are entering a different phase in archaeological research in which all of this is included. Not to say that that before people was not doing it right. People was doing it right also before. But I think now it's a different view on how things are being done. And I think it's interesting. I think it can bring us somewhere. And we'll see. We would always have the problem that the data that we have is biased, and there is nothing we can do about that. That's just the data that it is. It's scarce, it's fragmented, and we need to acknowledge this and look for ways to overcome these problems that we have with the data. And I think all these new, or not that new, methods, just by using statistics, different kinds of modeling, all of this is what can help us to overcome these problems with the data. And it cannot be anymore just a matter of my guess. It has to be something that we can all then reproduce, and then we can all reproduce that study and make sure how it worked, and all the things that come with the open data philosophy.
That's great. I think that's a perfect place to end it as well. So Alfredo, thank you so much for your time. And it's so nice to get your perspective on these things. How long are you going to be in Spain? Would you like to want to give you a chance to plug anything if you want to plug? Do you have any things that are coming out, or any writings or things that are forthcoming in the press that you want the listener to look out for?
So we have several articles that should come in the next months, and then we'll see. And in terms of the cave, well, we're doing lots of things that are pretty cool. We're even trying our own homemade GPR to see how it works for different things, because usually you cannot use these in small spaces because you need the car and everything. But in this case, we have a small one that one colleague of mine, Simon, you may know him as well, is actually developing in team with the engineering department. We're going to be trying these new methods in the cave, and we're going to be doing different things, and it's going to be interesting. And then this is the third campaign, so we are expecting that from this campaign. So up to now, the two first campaigns were basically knowing the cave, knowing what we have, what we're going to do. And now I think we are in a position to start getting interesting things. We'll see how it goes. Like I said before, it's not 100% sure, but I think in this case we can start getting some things. We'll see.
So what is this exactly? It's you said a GPR, was it? So is this like a automated robot of some sort, it sounds like?
Well, no, it's some kind of, so you know, you have this radar that kind of tells you if you have find something below the ground. Mm. Mm-hmm. But usually these are huge, and the ones that I've seen are super expensive. And so what we are doing is building one ourselves with the Department of Engineering. And the problem with this is that usually you cannot use those in caves, because you cannot bring them up to the cave because they are too large to be brought to the caves. But in this case, it's a smaller thing. And we have the intention to use this, as in some things that people, of course, don't know, is what happens if you say you open a trench and you go down, and after 50 centimeters, you find a huge rock which you cannot move. Well, then you just lost 3 days, and then you cannot do anything in there. And so the objective of this thing is kind of, if we're going to open something new, we first go with the radar and see if we can actually go deep. And if we can't, then we don't open in there. We look for someone. So it's kind of a pre-assessment of trying to mitigate the risks of the excavation. Because if you open different places and you lose a week and you always find the wrong spots, then you've lost a week of work. And excavations are usually not long, so a week is a significant amount of time loss. So we're trying to use this to kind of avoid these things. We'll see how it goes.
Interesting, because it feels like maybe it's in this era, as well, this sector as well, where something like AI or sort of unmanned technology come in handy, right? It helps you to save time. The thought occurred to me what you were explaining earlier, whether there could be an application not only in the analysis of data, but finding new sites, maybe through some sort of algorithm that says that maybe over here is where you should look, because they are already doing that.
Yeah, this is being incorporated. And like I said, some people working in Cambridge is doing that in places in India, most of all, but also they have been working with people from the ICAC, from Tarragona, working in Greece as well. So they are doing this kind of, kind of implementing AI to assess whether they could have new sites in this specific place or in this other place. So I saw some time ago, a paper trying to implement not exactly AI, but some kind of predictive mathematical modeling to assess potential Roman shipwrecks. So they are kind of trying to include all these things. Of course, all this is fairly new. Mm-hmm. So we need to grow our body of literature on this aspect. And also everything, there's so many variables that can influence where the site would potentially be. And we don't have all that many sites to account for all those potentially different variables. So we need to keep on working on our models, but sometimes they are giving good results. That's like what they are doing in India is giving good results. So yeah, it's something that we can continue to include in everything we do. We'll see. Yeah.
That's interesting. Cool. We're almost after an hour and I don't want to take more of your time while you're in Spain. So thank you again, Alfredo, for speaking to me.
Thank you.
And yeah. And see you when you're back in the UK at the next forum.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. And thank you very much for inviting me. And I guess I'll see you in some of the next Data Champions meetings and things. And we'll see you around. Okay.
So I'll just stop the recording.